Well, I've had Howard Bloom on as a guest over the years, as has Art. I believe Art was the last one to have him on in the spring. And I will say I'll never be the same after having read Global Brain. His other book, The Lucifer Principle, became a subject of conversation here on Coast to Coast for years, and I'm sure it'll be the same for his new book coming up, which is called Reinventing Capitalism: Putting Soul in the Machine, a Radical Reperception of Western Civilization. And ordinarily, it just like never read somebody's bio word for word as it is handed to us. But I'm going to do this in the case of Howard Bloom because I can't put it into my own words if I don't understand all of his. And that's just part of the majesty of Howard Bloom's brain. Almost single-handedly carved out two new fields, paleopsychology and mass behavior. His next goal is to establish a field he calls omnology. Howard's cross-disciplinary theories trace crowd patterns from the precipitation of the first protons in the Big Bang to future trends in the life of mankind, testing his theories of mass emotion in the brutal lab of reality. Howard Bloom helped shape the careers of Prince, John Cougar Mellencamp, Bette Midler, Billy Joel, and many others. He is a visiting scholar graduate in the psychology department at New York University and a core faculty member at the Graduate Institute. And all of these things, including being a founding board member of the Epoch of Evolution Society and the Darwin Project, somehow will inform us on what's going on in London, in radical Islam, in the Middle East, indeed the world, and the United States. We want to get Howard Bloom's reflection, our first chance to talk with him after the London bombings of last week. What does Howard Bloom see in this? What is Howard Bloom getting in his filter from all of the details we're getting in the last 48 hours about the London bombing? We'll get him coming up. You'll hear him on Coast to Coast AM. My name's Ian Punnett. Howard Bloom has always been one of my favorite conversation partners on Coast to Coast AM, so it's a pleasure to talk with him again on our first night back on this Saturday night. Hello, Howard.
Ian, it is an absolute pleasure to talk to you again.
Oh, God, I'm so glad you feel that way. I can't tell you. I mean, I still, things you said when we were talking about mass mind
Right.
have just hooked into me forever. And
Well, on the other hand, you have this incredible way of taking what a person like me, who can go wildly off all over the place for everything from protons and quarks to what's going to happen with Islam and the West in the future, and you can sum it up in a way that's absolutely astonishing to me.
Well, you've put me to the test again for tonight. We'll see how we do with this because I'm so curious about so many aspects of what you're talking about in this book, this upcoming book. When will it be out, Reinventing Capitalism?
Well, Reinventing Capitalism is still, we don't have a publishing date on that. And what we're doing is we're selling copies of the first draft on my website, howardbloom.net.
How about
And,
that?
but uh, the first draft has already gotten, Ian, the first draft has gotten reviews that you wouldn't believe. A page turner, it's normal. The normally things on economics and civilization aren't bestsellers. They don't grip you on every page. They don't create explosions on your brain on every page. And this book does strange things like that. So
Well,
we're moving ahead of the publishers. And what I've really been working on in the meantime is I was asked by the New York Military Affairs Symposium in January to sum up my 25 years of research on Islam in the West, and give them an overview, to explain to them why I felt that there had been over 1,000 years of war between Islam and the West, and why I agreed with Samuel Huntington's phrase that we do have a clash of civilizations. Now, Tony Blair, went on the radio in the last 24 hours, and he said, this is not a clash of civilizations. And I understand exactly why he's saying that. He has a very large Islamic community. The majority of the Islamic community in Britain, the United States, France, Italy, and Spain are peaceful people. They're driving cabs. They are running shops. They're working very hard to make a living. They love the fact that they've got freedom of speech, which they didn't have back home in whatever country they came from.
Right.
But their kids and their grandkids are growing up longing for this intense idealistic fervor. You know, idealistic fervor is like a drug, and it's one of the strongest drugs that you can receive when you're in your teens and you're in your 20s. And it seizes you, and you need it. You need the feeling that you are committed to something much, much larger than yourself.
Well, isn't, I mean, when we talk about it, I mean, don't we all have to say that all of our lives, in some way, are focused on trying to bring meaning to our existence?
Absolutely. You put your finger on it. And when it comes to selling meaning, the person who is selling meaning best in the world today, or one of the people who is selling meaning best, is Osama bin Laden.
Right.
Whether he's dead or alive, the fact is that right now in Asia, there are DVDs being sold of local beheadings. This is in southern Thailand. They're selling DVDs of local beheadings because the stuff that's going on in London in the last week is pale by comparison with what's going on in Thailand.
Right.
In the last couple of weeks and the last couple of years. So there are DVDs of all the beheadings, all the local beheadings, and they have titles like Jihad in Chechnya 2000. Now, every time our press hears Putin describe what's going on in Chechnya, Dagestan, Azerbaijan, all of the Central Asian former states of the USSR, every time he tries to say that these are part of a jihad, our journalists say that he is making this up, that these are separatist rebellions and they have nothing to do with each other. Well, how come Osama, in his speeches, rattles off the names of about 15 different countries in which the jihad is taking place? And they span the globe. They go all the way from the United States and England over to Thailand and the Philippines and all kinds of parts of Africa whose Islamic names you've never heard before. Why in the world is Osama talking about a world war, and a world war that involves almost every single continent on this planet, when our press says, no, that's not true, Putin is making this up?
Well, let me pick at that for a second, because we have to accept to a degree that Osama is also a good promoter.
Oh, he's brilliant.
He turns
out videos that it's been said that his videos make rock videos look absolutely primitive by comparison.
But in that way, it's in his best interest. It's part of his perhaps wishful thinking that he's having that big an impact in every corner of the world. Now, I'm not saying he doesn't, but I mean, at some point, don't we have to see him as a little bit like a McCarthy-esque figure, you know, who holds up a sheet and says, I have here, you know, all this secret information, where it only helps to trump up Osama bin Laden's global image to say that he has that kind of a wide-ranging, you know, effect on world politics and separatist movements?
Well, I think you've done a very accurate thing when you pointed to McCartney because of McCarthy. Sorry, McCartney's not in this. The Beatles are not in this one. But when you pointed to Joseph McCarthy, because McCarthy painted things in an easy black and white. And for people who wanted a simple explanation of things, they're
right,
the bad guys and we're the good guys, McCarthy was it. And Osama is one of many people who are it in the Islamic community, who say there's a simple batch of bad guys and they're the unbelievers.
Right.
And there's a simple bunch of good guys, and that's us, the believers in Islam. But there's an element that McCarthy only had to a very small extent, and Osama has to a very large extent. Osama is able to point straight back to a history that begins in 624 AD, when Muhammad the Prophet was told that jihad, that is, war in the name of the truth,
right,
war in the name of God, and war in the name of justice, was allowed. And ever since then, and he's got the example, Muhammad has, or Osama, has the example of a prophet who is radically different from the prophets that you and I know when we think of Moses and Jesus, we automatically think that a prophet is a man of peace. One of the two leading exponents, the two leading explainers of the Islamic tradition and of the Quran in the last 50 years have been the Ayatollah Khomeini and Osama bin Laden. Those two have had the biggest influence on the Islamic world.
Yeah, when we take that Arabic word, you know, jihad, to peaceful Muslims, they prefer to read the interpretation of that in the other way that you can define that word jihad as conflict. And we talk about a war on poverty, or we talk about the war on sin, or, you know, and so that sort of thing. And we use that kind of word in that context, and we really mean it as a conflict either within ourselves. You know, our bodies are at war in many ways, sort of spiritually all the time, between good and evil, but also, you know, and we're trying to do something as a greater good. Now, right. Why can't we look at it like that?
Well, we can look at it like that because the people who are fighting us, the people who blow up bombs, the people who are blowing themselves up and taking down 13 people with them, as the 18-year-old did who blew himself up on a double-decker bus last week in London,
right.
These kids are doing it for the greater good. These kids are doing it because they know that there is only one truth, and that anyone who lives under any other system is living under tyranny, under oppression, under falsehood, and is ultimately being driven by leaders like Tony Blair and George Bush Jr., and even by Jefferson and George Washington and Hamilton, is being taken by these misled people down the path to hell. Now, if you saw an entire nation of close to 300 million people, like the nation of the United States, being dragged to hell by its heels, and meantime being narcoticized and blinded to the fact that it's being driven to hell, wouldn't you want to liberate them?
Yeah.
Wouldn't you want to save them?
Right,
if there's
the
only one set of laws that offers justice, and Americans are being denied it, wouldn't you want to liberate them so they could have true justice? If they were living under what you felt was tyranny and oppression, the tyranny and oppression of ideas so false that even the word false is not strong enough to describe them, so satanic that it defies belief, wouldn't you want to liberate them? Well, in the eyes of those who are fighting jihad, in the eyes of those who, like the London kids, are claiming to be associated with Al-Qaeda, they call themselves something like one of the brigades of Al-Qaeda, and so did the kids who blew up the trains. And I say kids because a lot of these are people who are 18 to 22 years old.
Right, the oldest one's 30. Now seems like a kid to me. But.
Yeah, and you and I are old men by now. But back in Spain, it was the same thing. These people are not blowing up trains in order to blow up 130 people or 200 people or whatever the figure happens to be. They are doing it to save Spain. They are doing it to save Europe. They are doing it to save England. They are doing it to save the population of the United States and to liberate them.
And at the same time, to return to that thought, to bring meaning to their lives.
Absolutely, because if you're fighting in the name of what's good and pure and just, then you are an idealist to the nth degree. You're not fighting on your own behalf. What is a suicide bomber? Yes, the suicide bomber is promised 70 virgins. We all know that. And the descriptions of the paradise that he's promised are lush beyond belief. They are just astonishingly gorgeous. But that's not why these people are blowing themselves up. These people are blowing themselves up in their eyes to save you and me.
Right. And I want to get to a discussion of that more, because I hear already, I think, a trend in what you're saying, and I want to see how that tied back into that group from the Pentagon that you were talking about earlier. But something you said struck me because it reminded me so much of post-World War I Germany, pre-World War II.
Oh, you've got it.
Because, I mean, in that sense, Adolf Hitler's appeal was less to the older generation who had been through war. They weren't interested in any more bloodshed. And he went right to the youth, and he went right to the kids, Those were the people whose lives he was going to bring meaning to. And the older generation tended to be the one much more skeptical of Adolf Hitler. They had seen Adolf Hitler's before.
Right.
But the power came in appealing to the imagination of the youth.
Well, let's go back even a few years earlier. Before World War One, there was a tremendous hunger among the German people and also among many other people in Europe for a sense of meaning. And they felt that their civilization had become old and had become feeble and had become corrupt. And they felt that the civilization needed to be cleansed and brought back to life in passion and purity. And do you know what they thought was going to save them, was going to give them the passion, the purity, the fire, the new sense of life that they so desperately needed, the meaning in their lives, but with adrenaline pumped all the way through it? They thought it was going to be World War One. And when they marched off to World War One, they were jubilant. They were absolutely jubilant. This was going to give them a sense of belonging to something far, far bigger than themselves. And, of course, they came out of that war disillusioned. That's what happened to the older generation.
They thought it would bring them virtue,
yes,
like honor.
More than even virtue. It would bring them an exaltation. And that exaltation of being caught up into the being of something so much bigger than yourself that it defies belief. Well, Adolf Hitler was a magician at creating that sense of being caught up in something far bigger than oneself. He created torchlit parades that involved up to a million people, every single moment of which was choreographed. Every single thing that went on in the streets was set up by Albert Speer, who was an artist and an architect, so that every bit of set design that could be brought to bear was brought to bear. Why? So that you, standing in the crowd shouting, Ein Führer, Ein Reich, Ein Volk, one Führer, one leader, one people, one state, so that you shouting that would feel this dizzying sense of being caught up in a truth so much bigger than yourself that it was amazing, and being caught up in a truth that went all the way back in history to the original Germans 3,200 years ago. That's when the Aryan myth of the Aryan origin of the Germans was created. And you need a creation myth. People need a creation myth to get a sense of that kind of meaning that you and I are talking about. Well, what does Osama have to offer? He offers one of the greatest creation myths around. There were, God sent many prophets. He sent over 1,200 prophets to the human race. And do you know what the human race did with them? It turned every single one of them aside with the exception of two. And those two were Moses and Jesus. But do you know what those rotten, terrible humans did once they heard the truth of God and embraced it? They corrupted it. They turned it into a pile of lies. So the Old Testament is nothing but a heap of lies. It was originally God's word, but it's been twisted and mangled by those insidious people, the Jews, who are the dandruff of Satan for all practical purposes. And then Christ was given the accurate message from the lips of God himself. And what did the Christians do? Over the course of the next 300 years, they did exactly what the Jews had done. They twisted it, they mangled it, they turned it into lies. And the only people who ever really listened, when God finally sent another prophet, by now it's 1,200 prophets, when God finally sent another prophet, one people listened. And those were the people of Arabia. Because those people living in the desert were pure. Those people living in the desert were not weighed down with earthly luxuries. And in reality, those people lived in two major cities, Mecca and Medina. But the fact is, they were way out there in the desert, and they were prepared to do something no other people had been prepared to do. They were prepared to look back every year at the example God had left them and compare their own behavior to that model behavior, that model of virtue, of God's own virtue, and to correct their behavior, not by coming up with new historical adaptations, not by coming up with new ways of adapting to the future, but by constantly referring everything they did to the past.
All right. Hang on that thought. And let's come back to that, because what we're building here, I think, is a much more accurate portrayal of Osama bin Laden as a much better image of a modern Hitler than Saddam Hussein, who doesn't even make a very good Mussolini. But we'll pick up this thought and we'll see where Howard Bloom takes us next on Coast to Coast AM. Howard Bloom is our guest for a while, and I'm not sharing him. So those of you who are trying to get through on the phones, hang on for a little while yet, but we'll get to him. And I know that a lot of people are hanging on this conversation as I am, because we're we're building on something which Howard started with, which is basically that 9/11 and the London bombings are just two more dots along the timeline of the longest running world war in history. But we were kind of paralleling that a little bit before the break about Adolf Hitler and the power of myth, and how Osama bin Laden, perhaps in a way which, because it's happening in Asian countries, because it's happening in developing nations, we're not hearing about it as much, as much as we might if it were, say, happening in Europe, like it is with the London bombings, but that Osama bin Laden is following along the same trajectory as Adolf Hitler with his propaganda and with his manipulation of youth, especially on getting kids who already have middle-class lives, who may already have an education, may already have families, but getting them to long for a mythic past that never was, and then empowering them to be able to bring this non-existent past into our present if they are willing to sacrifice their lives, giving them the greatest meaning of all time. And the power of this, as we see from World War II, when you tell people that this is your job, it is fallen upon you, this generation, to be here at the crossroads of all civilization, this is the most terrifying motivator. It goes well beyond the technology.
Well, Ian, you've done a brilliant job, and one of the things that many, many Islamic leaders around the world, who you're not supposed to hear, are saying to kids is, it is your job to save the human race, not just to save one continent, not just to save one country, but to save the entire human race. And that's a very powerful message. Adolf Hitler was trying to deliver that message, but think of the extent of his war. It was relatively tiny. It stretched over a distance of approximately 3,000 miles. The Islamic war that was running within 100 years of Muhammad's death already stretched a distance of 13,500 miles. Within 100 to 200 years of Muhammad's death, the Islamic Empire, remember, Islam has been on the path of imperialism and on the path of colonialism and has not been called on it for 1,381 years. And as I said, within 100 to 200 years of Muhammad's death, the Empire of Islam already was the size of five Roman empires combined. So we're dealing with history. We're dealing with, yes, myth. The power of myth is extraordinarily important. And the stories of origins are vital to the power of myth. But in Germany's case, the Brothers Grimm went looking for old stories to revive a sense of the German Volk, of what the German tribe had been like way back when. 70 years later, Wagner, the composer, put together grand operas, which were supposed to be massive panoramic experiences for the sight and in sound, about Siegfried and the Nibelungen. These Siegfried was the hero of the German people, who embodied the German people's desire to be heroic. He climbed the mountain. He went into the cavern where the dragon had been protecting a hoard of treasure and a princess. And no one had ever been able to conquer the dragon before, but Siegfried, who represented the German people, was able to do it. And Adolf Hitler pulled on all of that mythic background. But that was nothing compared to what Osama is able to pull on, because he is able to pull on the story, on a true story. He is able to pull on the story of Muhammad the Prophet. And as I was saying before, there was a very strange statement that I dug out years ago, decades ago, when doing this research. The Ayatollah Khomeini said about Jesus, certainly the Christians, those barbarian Christians, are lying to us about Jesus. They say that he turned the other cheek. We know what true prophets are like. We have not mangled the truth about our prophets. And we know that prophets are men who are willing to kill and to be killed. In other words, they are men who are willing to fight in battle. Now, how did he know that a prophet was a killer? He knew that because Muhammad, the one prophet who got the message right, leading the one people who stayed true to that message for the next nearly 1,400 years, Muhammad led, or he commandeered, he was the commander in charge of over 60 military operations. He personally led 29 military operations. In the last military operation that he ran, that he was personally in charge of, every other Islamic warrior fled from the battlefield. And Muhammad stayed alone on the battlefield with his sword hacking away at the limbs and necks of his enemy in order to rally his troops. And this is what the Ayatollah meant when he said that a prophet is a man who is willing to kill and be killed. So the example of the perfect man, Ian, for you and me to be just and proper and holy and virtuous and to shine as an example to our fellow human beings, we have to model our lives minute by minute and hour by hour on the life of the prophet himself, because he was the template handed directly by God to us humans to show us what holiness and propriety are like.
Well, and then in a way, then that brings us back to what Tony Blair had said within the last 24 hours, which in part started this conversation, because he said, this is not about a clash of cultures. And can we say fairly then that the majority of, you know, peace-loving Muslims in England are part of that same ideal from Western civilization, that the role of a prophet or the role of the righteous is not to hack away at the arms and the necks of their enemies, but rather to find a way to live together in a pluralistic society, and that this other belief is this sort of viral belief that is catching hold, as we're seeing, you know, through this building of imagination and the insistence that this generation must do something about it now. It really is not part of Western civilization, even though these kids grew up in England. That somehow, if you want to use a computer term, the file has become corrupted.
Well, okay, from the Islamic point of view, the file of the parents, the ones who are pluralistic and believe in freedom of speech, has become corrupted. I believe, as you do, that most of the Muslims living in the Western world have come here because they want to, and they come here because they want freedom of speech. They come here because they want pluralism. They come here to live in peace with others. They come here to make more money and have a better standard of living and be able to send their kids through school and all kinds of other privileges that they wouldn't have had back in Pakistan or Bangladesh or Malaysia or Indonesia. But that's a guess, because I once said to one of my Islamic friends, if only 10% of the Islamic community of the world believes in the militant Islamic message, that's 120 million people. And that's more than the combined population of France, Germany, and England at the beginning of World War II. And he said to me, 10%? Are you kidding? And I thought he was going to tell me it should be 2% or 5%. And you should have seen. I looked crestfallen because I thought I had gotten it desperately wrong. And he said, you have gotten it desperately wrong. It's 70%. This is an Islamic friend. Now remember, this is not an expert. This is a man who's in the social sciences, but his expertise isn't in Western Islam, even though he lives in an Islamic community right here in Brooklyn near me. And we have some of the biggest Islamic communities in the world here in Brooklyn, over in New Jersey, and over in, and out in Detroit.
Well, we'll take a moment here. When we return to this conversation, tell me, Howard Bloom, how you nuance the difference between the word Muslim and Islamicist, or...
Well, I prefer to use the term jihadist.
Okay, or even jihadist. We'll get to that in a second. But more than that, too, is then let's get into the nuts and bolts of what the Quran orders. Is it true that the Quran is ordering this 70% or whatever percentage it is to torture Westerners? It's not even a matter of whether or not they should be killed, but it's how we should be killed. And where you get evidence of that, or, you know, is this for real? And then we have to get to the nuclear question from militant Islam, and we'll do it next with Howard Bloom on Coast to Coast AM. My name's Ian Punnett. Howard Bloom is the author of an upcoming book, Reinventing Capitalism, Putting Soul in the Machine, A Radical Reperception of Western Civilization. I believe that's a title with two subtitles. Are you allowed two subtitles in publishing?
You're not. I break the rules all the time.
Okay.
It's great fun.
And then and the book is available now in its first draft on your website?
Yes, on howardbloom.net.
Okay. And you can go there and you can buy the first.
Yep. You just click and you get a copy. Well, a copy comes in the mail to you.
Okay. And then no big surprise then that you're shifting the paradigm of publishing, which kind of is based on the notion of exclusivity, that you would have some sort of product which is proprietary that you can have, that, you know, something you could buy, that you would own, that it was in some sort of final form. And now, especially with this kind of e-publishing, and if you're doing going to sell it on drafts, that's kind of a new way of looking at.
Well, I want to bring my readers into the process of writing the book.
Yeah, I was going to say, it sort of changes the way in which participation, and it makes people, probably make people curious on how the first draft is going to differ from the last draft.
Right, and also it means that I read things from my fans or from the people who read my stuff as diligently as I possibly can, and I get a lot out of it. And so this book is going to be changed by some of the things that some of my fans have to say. Although it's pretty much, it's about 75% finished now, and it's regarded as pretty startling stuff. But, and the relevance, by the way, of this book to the subject of Islam that we're talking about right now is this. We've got two civilizations up against each other. Tony Blair is wrong. The folks in the Islamic community who are militants refer to this as a clash of civilizations. One of Osama's favorite phrases is the clash of civilizations. And so the question is it really worth saving our civilization? Do we have anything superior to offer to what Islam has to offer? I mean, Islam offers a long and illustrious history. Islam invented the algebra. Islam presented us with the zero. Islam invented the entire technique for tacking against the wind and sailing. It invented a new form of trade between the Mediterranean and Europe and India and China. So it's been responsible for quite a few important things, including saving Plato, Aristotle, and the rest of the Greek classics for us. So why is our civilization in any way superior to the Islamic civilization? Because, well, among other things, our civilization will accomplish two major things. In 1790, our civilization started something the world had never, ever seen before, an organized protest industry, an organized balance against rulers and against those who made large amounts of money. And that protest industry started out by protesting the slavery, and this is the first civilization that ever produced an anti-slavery movement. Now, let's look at slavery for a minute. 10 million slaves were exported from Africa to the rest of the Western world. It's called the African Holocaust, and for good reason. Only 6 million people were killed, 6 million Jews were killed in Hitler's Holocaust, but 10 million Africans were involved in the African Holocaust. But the African Holocaust, the Western slavery business, was almost nothing compared to the Islamic slavery industry. The Islamic slavery industry affected 120 million Africans. That's 12 times as many Africans, and a total of 220 million human beings. Why? Because the Islam had the biggest fleet in the Mediterranean, and the Mediterranean was for a long, long time, for centuries, an Islamic lake. And that meant that slave raiding expeditions were taking place on the coasts of Ireland, the coast of England, the coast of France, the coast of Italy, and they were taking place nonstop. And white slaves were being sold all over the Islamic Empire. This means, and I'm trying to check this fact out, but it means, so far as I can tell, that you could buy an Irish woman for your sexual pleasure if you happen to be a sultan in the Philippines, again, 13,000 miles away. Nothing like this has ever existed in the West. And Islam has never had the equivalent of our anti-slavery movement in 1790, of our anti-war movement, which Henry David Thoreau helped get off the ground with the civil disobedience in roughly 1845 in protest of the Mexican-American War. It hasn't had the equivalent to our anti-imperialist movement, which put out one of its great declarations in 1890. It hasn't had the equivalent to our women's rights movement. In other words, the protest industry, as an industry, using all of the tools of industry, which means mass production of pamphlets, mass production of every form of mass media that's become available in the West. This is unique to the West. And Islam and no other civilization, including that of China, which has been around for 3,000 years now, has anything equivalent. The second thing is, every idealistic system on the face of the planet has presented itself to people like you and me, who need idealism desperately, by saying, this system will lift the poor and the oppressed. Marxism, for example, is a good idea. Christianity, or a good example. Christianity is a good example. There's only one system that has really lifted the poor and the oppressed. And back in roughly 500 years ago, you lived in one set of clothing all year long. It was made of animal fiber. It housed tens of thousands of parasites who all lived off of you. You weren't able to launder it because it shrank. I mean, try putting a sweater into the washing machine, and you'll see exactly what happens. You weren't able to bathe very often. And then came the Industrial Revolution. And what were the first machines in the Industrial Revolution? They were textile-making machines, machines that took one worker and made that worker able to turn out at first the work of 10 previous workers in the old-style system of making fabrics, and then 100. One person could do the work of 100 workers. The result was that when one of my clients, Stuart Copeland, the founder of the Police, the band, went to Africa to go see the native tribes from which he believed he had derived his rhythms, and he went to see some of the most isolated tribes in Africa, tribes that only people in anthropology know about, the Djibouti and a whole bunch of others. No matter where he went to see tribes that were making a cash total of $1.15 a year. In other words, almost no cash whatsoever. They weren't part of the modern commercial system whatsoever. And do you know what they were wearing? They were all wearing cotton. Cotton was the cloth of kings 400 years ago. Only kings could afford cotton. And now even the poorest people on the face of the planet own it. What's more, there's this entire vast, vast group of people in the West called the middle class. And if you go back and you look at their grandparents or their great-grandparents, those people were poor. Well, that's lifting the poor and the oppressed so permanently that we take the permanence of the middle class for granted. No other civilization has pulled off a miracle of that kind or anywhere near it. Certainly Islam has not. Well, is there something superior about Western civilization? Why in the world does an author named Howard Bloom have to go and write a book that has a third subtitle, A Radical Reperception of Western Civilization? Because we don't know this stuff about our own civilization.
Not to mention that by the time you're done writing drafts of this, you might have a third or a fourth subtitle.
Yes.
With every draft, you could add a new subtitle.
In 63 chapters and 63 short stories, it tells the entire history of Western civilization from 2.5 million years ago, when we first invented stone tools, and all kinds of strange things happened as a result that we're not normally told about, to today. And why? Because, Ian, you got it on the head when you said we need myths. We need our creation myths.
Yeah,
this is a real story of our creation myth of where we came from and how we got to be what we are today. And it's so radically different from anything you've been told in your life that it's absurd.
Well, I want to explore more of this, too, coming up. And here's an SAT question to think about, but don't answer. I don't know where you are with this, so just tell me how this fits. Is Islam is to Islamicist as Judaism is to Zionist. Think about that. Is that accurate? Does that even begin to compare? And then we have to get to the nuclear danger question next on what Howard Bloom sees on this. And I'm pretty sure that in his list of Arabic accomplishments, he forgot Turkish taffy. But I'll ask him after the break coming up. Top of the hour news, and then more with Howard Bloom on Coast to Coast AM. My name's Ian Punnett.